Welcome to the Phil Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:22, and that is Pacific Summer Time. And today is Friday, May 27th. And of course, being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And the market had been waiting with bated breath for what was Janet Yellen going to say at this event where she was being presented with a medal by Harvard. And she basically said nothing for the first 20 minutes and then said that the Fed was on track to raise rates in the middle of the year. So what did that? What kind of result did that have? Well, markets were, in fact, incredibly orderly and no great volatility, suggesting that people are beginning to price this in. And the 12-month yield now is already pricing in a rate hike pretty soon. And isn't that far away from pricing in two rate hikes within the next 12 months? And stocks are very steady. Now, I was at this talk given by Jeff Gundlach yesterday, and he's a very smart guy and a market timer to boot, and has a view of the world not entirely alien from ours. So I was rather interested to hear what he had to say about the bond markets. And he expresses many of the same views on the bond market that we do, that yields have in all likelihood bottomed, that there is a debt overhang, but he also highlights the fact that it's unlikely to become a big problem until we start to see the refinancing cliff approached, and that's not from really until 2018. But he highlighted an important chart right at the end of his presentation, and it was the non-financial debt to GDP ratio. And it's high, and it's been going up for a long time, and it's been largely going sideways, which exemplifies the point that there hasn't really been a great deal of deleveraging in the post-crisis era, but rather there's been a transfer of debt from the private sector to the public sector. Now, then it all depends who, and perhaps it doesn't largely depend on who wins the election, but there are certainly some candidates running for president that are more liable to run fiscal deficits and to engage in deficit spending than others. So that could potentially see that debt to GDP ratio expand even further, which would have short-term and potentially even medium-term economic benefits, and would justify a higher premium on stocks. Of course, the aftermath of that would be a bubble. And that is kind of where we are right now in terms of the stock market. And thinking about what is it exactly that could really drive this market higher. And one of those things is deficit spending, for sure. That if the the USA is badly in need of additional infrastructure, and hopefully that wouldn't all be on Hyperloop, trams from Los Angeles to San Francisco, but rather maybe going towards replacing some of the 70,000 bridges that are in need of repair. And of course, that would create employment. It would help to give additional employment to the people that are trying to hold down two and three part-time jobs because they can't get a full-time job. And then that would also help the stock market to improve, because more people employed with better paying jobs means more spending. More spending means higher corporate profits, and corporate profits have been disappointing, which is why people have been a bit antsy, why the market has been going sideways. So then what is the Fed likely to do? And then one of the things he said was that there wasn't any real argument for why stocks should go higher, and perhaps that was the best argument of all, that nobody could really articulate a very good argument. But I don't think it's difficult to articulate an argument for why stocks might go higher. But the problem for a lot of investors is that it is not an argument based on value. And what it really comes down to is that the market has already been going up for the last 7 years. We have gone through the two of the psychological perception stages. There was utter disbelief that markets could move higher from 2009 onwards. That transferred into acceptance between about late 2011 and early 2015. People really got the message. This was a strong market, that there was abundant liquidity, that there was that the Fed was putting a bid under the market. Then we had this very powerful advance, and we've had a loss of momentum since. People are casting around now for reasons, and the most healthy thing would be that we get additional consolidation, which would allow some of that overbought condition in terms of valuations to be unwound. But we might not get that. What we might get is an additional acceleration in terms of the overvaluation of fixed assets and financial assets, property assets. And what that would represent is the beginning of the third phase of a major bull market, which is acceleration, and categorized by an investment mania, where people really just throw in the towel, say, the bearish prognosticators have been wrong. We can only really begin to think about this in terms of all the good news that there is out there, and that the economy is resurgent, everyone is employed, everyone has more money, there's more risk-taking going on, and all of that is very positive indeed. And of course, if you're making money in the stock market, you're making money in your job, and your bonuses are improving, your optimism towards the future would cause and effect would improve. And so there is the argument for the potential for additional upside. And of course, if we do enter a mania, it would suggest that the aftermath of that mania would be a crash. And that is the likelihood. And of course, now we have to look at, is there any supporting argument for why we might have a mania? And then the Fed is a serial bubble blower. And they themselves, and Janet Yellen even said today that they are trying their very best to identify anything that would cause a financial disruption to the financial system. But at the same time, the Fed is also on record previously as saying that a bubble is impossible to identify until after the fact. And certainly the Fed, just by virtue of the fact that they have to wait for evidence, means that they will always be behind the curve, because they don't feel like that they're in a position that they can predict what's going to happen. And particularly considering that they have invested so much political capital in trying to rescue the economy, then they will be are more than likely going to allow the to leave the liquidity in the market for longer than is needed, and arguably it's already been there for longer than was needed, and then they're going to be very slow about raising rates. So inflation is likely to move higher in the second half of the year, simply by virtue of the fact that prices, particularly for food and energy, have rallied fairly spectacularly over the last 6 months. And just on a year-over-year basis, they will look like they are higher, which will feed through into the... that's just the technicals of the market. Now, that's probably already in the price. And the one thing that the Fed is very clearly looking at is wage growth. And today, Janet Yellen was lamenting the fact that productivity growth hasn't been great, but that employment growth is picking up, and that they do anticipate wages picking up. And that is one of the primary reasons that they would raise rates. Everything else being equal, with having achieved a number of their mandates, the stated mandates that they said that they would raise rates when they saw results in, like employment. And like GDP growth and even and less so CPI. Well, now they are looking at wages because that really does move the needle in terms of CPI. Now, when we take a step back, then we're still in this range. And the S&P 500 closed today at 2099, excuse me. And by and large, it was a relatively quiet day elsewhere on stock markets. But when you look at those weekly charts, this was an impressive week. And it constitutes an upward dynamic from the region of the 200-day moving average. And this has been a very orderly consolidation, mostly above the 200-day MA, which unwound. The overbought condition evidence since that big rally up from January, and all of the things being equal, if you were to take the names off the charts and simply ask, do you think it's more likely to go up or down, and you would have to say that it is more likely now to go up in the absence of a clear downward dynamic. And of course, we might yet get that clear downward dynamic, but in the short term, I have to admit that I feel conflicted because I feel like I should have a short position, but I don't. I was shorting positions. I was shorting the market up here the last time it was at this level. And I closed out those shorts before we've had this rally, and I'm tempted to come back in, but I don't feel like I need to anticipate. I think I am going to wait until I see some evidence that there is resistance at the upper side of this 18-month range, for the simple reason that a range is an explosion waiting to happen. And this is most definitely a well-defined range. And if we do see the market breaking to the upside, well then it is likely to do so in an emphatic way, and we could have the market rallying very impressively indeed. And it would surprise everyone, and not least myself, if that were to happen. It is a possibility, because we know what happens when ranges are completed. And when they are resolved, they tend to resolve in an emphatic way, simply because a vacuum of supply is penetrated above the market and prices will rally until supply comes back into the market. So we're living in a very interesting time indeed. This is the time to really pay attention to what is happening in these stocks. And we've practically posted that chart of the S&P 500 almost every day for the last few weeks, because it is important to really keep an eye on it, because when you look at just about every other market in the world, they've pretty much all deteriorated except Wall Street. But that's perhaps the most important thing, is that there's a Wall Street leash effect. It doesn't really work the other way around. When the rest of the world pulls back, Wall Street generally then tends to exhibit safe haven characteristics, and that is certainly what we've had. Wall Street has simply ranged, whereas everything else has had these larger pullbacks. Well, we've already seen that the majority of emerging market indices have found support, and their currencies have found support. And that would suggest then that when we're looking at the dollar, we can't simply look at the dollar index. The dollar index continues to look like it is, it has posted a failed downside break below 92. And the dynamic of the failure has been greater than the dynamic of the breakdown. So it is more likely than not to go right back up and test the upper side of its range, which is around 100. Now, that's a bit of a headwind for commodity prices, and commodities did very well in the beginning of the year when the dollar was so weak. But what we do see evidence of is that the precious metals in particular are not pulling back by nearly to the same extent that the dollar is rallying. And part of the reason for that is because there is a general tendency among investors to seek a safe haven. Now, it is questionable whether, if the stock market breaks on the upside, whether they would still feel the need to have a safe haven. But if we continue to see stock markets going sideways, well, then the faith in the ability of central banks to get it right. And perhaps the Fed is the exemplar for getting it right. And the experiment with negative yields, where you have $7.8 trillion yielding negative numbers, that's a rather bizarre scenario, because it's the very definition of deflation. If you put money in the bank and you take it out and you get back less than you put in, then there's got to be a problem with that. And, you know, the what we have seen is that with that deflationary environment, the euro strengthened, the yen strengthened, and because they're deliberately not inflating their currencies. Now, those central banks have been doing lots of other things as well, and trying to balance the impact of negative rates. But it's hard to really point to a success story from negative rates, and not least because they're trying to achieve inflation, and that's certainly not what they're getting. So do we then perhaps move to a new environment where they try something else? And, well, that's something else that they could try is outright money printing and simply sending people checks in the mail. Now, that's referred to as helicopter money. And, of course, you know, what they could also do, and obviously inflating your way out of a debt problem is one solution. And the other solution is cancelling the debt or forgiving the debt. And Japan is more probably capable of doing that than Europe, not least because the political situation in Europe is so fragmented. Japan could do that because they hold most of their debt domestically, and a lot of that debt is held by the state pension fund. There are certainly additional tools, and that really does give the lie to anyone who says that a central bank is out of policy tools. That the central bank has infinite policy tools because they can literally do whatever it is that they want, and all that that stops them is their conviction. And what we've seen from central banks is that they really are willing to try anything at all. So it would be rash to put a limit on what it is that they're willing to try in order to get the types of things that they want. Now, if we do move down the route of money printing, then that will act as an additional inflator to asset prices. And then we end up with a problem later on. But that problem that we could have later on might not be a problem for years yet. And then the big question is, if we really are at the beginning of a mania phase in stocks, well then, that's the time to be invested. Because you want to participate in the mania, because it's the time when prices go up fastest. So but you also want to bear in mind that there are problems brewing, and that's going to be the time when it's most difficult to remember what those problems are, because there's nobody going to be interested in them. And so then you really do need to keep an eye on a whole broad spectrum of various indicators, because you will get indications of when the next recession is likely to be, but none of the indicators for recession are flashing red right now. Now, they're trending that way, but we might be 2 or 3 years away from the next recession. So we've had a range already on Wall Street. Europe has pulled back by in the region of 30%. So I think that Europe today is probably where the US was in 2011. And the ECB this week, they have negative rates. And one of the things that they're trying to do to balance that out, because they really do want the banking sector to lend more. But how on earth can the banking sector lend more when the collateral that they're posting with the ECB is depreciating in value, for the simple reason that they post it as collateral and they get less back? So, then how can they bolster their balance sheets in that kind of environment? Well, the ECB this week told them that they will basically take anything at all as collateral. And that allows banks to unload even more of the toxic non-performing debt that they owned. And so that has generally been positive for the banking sector, and generally banks were higher. And of course, the U.S. banking sector is doing better because they haven't been making money on money market funds. And I remember at the Country Opinion Forum in, I think it was last year, where a chap from Northern Trust, which is one of the biggest stock lenders in the world, was saying that they would immediately start turning a profit on money market funds of around, I think it was something in the region of $4 or $5 million whenever the Fed rose interest rates. And, you know, because they have just had no lending margins at all. So with the banking sector picking up and the commodity sector picking up and technology remaining spotty and the biotech sector having steadied after a big decline, you know, it's not as if there isn't some value in this market, and people just lack the conviction because they're worried about a whole slew of different things. And, you know, the reality is that a bull market climbs a wall of worry, and we certainly have that wall of worry right now. There's a lot of things to worry about, and they're non-trivial. And then we really do have to monitor what it is that the market is telling us, because right now we're at the upper side of that range, and it really would need a downward dynamic and a clear downward dynamic to institute a failure here. Now, when we look at, you know, what the positive stories are, then one of the really most interesting anecdotes, in fact, when I was taking notes, the only notes I took were to just, I wrote down on my piece of paper, don't forget this anecdote. And that was the only note I took in that talk yesterday. And it was that Jeff Gundlach met with the strategist for the biggest sovereign wealth fund in the Middle East last week. And they had a wide-ranging conversation, but this strategist said that they were basing all of their investing decisions on the proposition that oil could trade at $10 a barrel. And that's particularly interesting since oil this week clipped $50 a barrel and has almost doubled off its low when you look at that Brent crude price. Now, the three reasons that they gave for why oil prices might fall that much were, one, that the fracking community in the US has drilled a lot more wells than they are producing from right now, and that they're waiting for prices to go up enough to justify the expense of bringing those wells online. But once those wells come online, then that will represent a significant additional flow of supply, and then prices will start to come back down. And you know, that's probably a short-term consideration. But what it does suggest and really confirm is something that we've talked about quite a lot in the audios and in the commentary, and it is that hydraulic fracturing really is a game changer for the energy sector, because it makes supply it makes what was previously inelastic supply elastic. It means that because these hydraulic fractured wells or unconventional wells have incredibly prolific initial supply, but that they quickly and they generally peak within a year and a half. So if you don't continue to drill new wells or you don't go back and refrack, then the supply from the well will tail off. And if prices are falling in that environment, then you don't spend the additional money. And then you're not losing money, and you're holding onto your reserve until you can get a better price for it. And with that kind of elastic supply, it means that when prices are high, they'll produce more, and when prices are low, they'll produce less. And that will lock this market into a volatile range. Now, if countries like Saudi Arabia are considering, they're looking at that elastic supply situation from the US, and they have decided to pump as much as they can, and to just open the spigot and to capture as much value as they possibly can, then they're not just looking at short-term or even medium-term elastic supply in the US. They're looking at other things, and here are the two other things. The first is the growth in the electric vehicle market. Now, China has gone from about 11,000 electric vehicles in 2011 to having a target of having 5 million electric vehicles on the road by 2020. And they've got a long way to go. So then that means that they're anticipating growing their electric vehicle fleet by 30% a year between now and 2020. And really, that's just China. And when you start to look at the range that is possible on some of the cars that are out there now, where 200 miles is achievable, but what happens when those electric vehicles get up to 500 miles? You know, that's challenging the range of even the most fuel-efficient car right now. And also considering how long it takes in a day to drive 500 miles, then most people would be willing to take a rest if they were running out of fuel, or they would stop and have a meal and then continue. So considering where we are in terms of the technology, it's not that much more that is required to really change the useful dynamics of the electric car market. And then what this strategist from the Middle Eastern Sovereign Wealth Fund was saying was that they anticipate that could remove 4 million barrels a day of demand from the US energy market. And that is huge. Considering how much the US consumes right now, that's enormous. And consider the impact that the removal of a million barrels of supply had on the oil price. And then you consider what the headwind to higher prices is if you get 4 million barrels of demand taken out of the global market for oil. Then prices really would be locked in lower levels and for the foreseeable future. And that's before we even begin to talk about renewable energy. And there was another record broken this week in the efficiency of a non-concentrating light solar cell. Of course, there are two kinds of solar cell. There are those that use lenses to concentrate the light, and with those kinds, you use a four junction concentrating lens on a solar cell, and you can get in excess of 40% efficiency. But I think this week it was a new record in a non-concentrating solar cell, and it's like 34%. Now, those are not the solar cells that you're buying when you get them installed on your roof, but those will be the solar cells you'll be getting 5 or 6 years from now. So the technology is improving rapidly. And when you start to get those types of technology being commercialized, and you start getting see-through solar cells commercialized so that your window becomes a generating facility, and when you start to get battery technology getting commercialized, then that represents a sea change in terms of the demand for energy. And with abundant energy, you get economic growth. And that is what has driven economic growth for the last 200 years. So then we have the just a very necessary component for a secular bull market, and something that could help to support valuations for the foreseeable future. So then we have to square that away with what the bullish prognostication might be when we have this debt problem. And you know, it could potentially mean that the debt problem is not as bad as would have been otherwise. We could potentially get into a scenario where we really are in the best possible world, where we do get growth and productivity improvements that help to help the debt to improve. And consider, and I really would look at that debt to GDP ratio chart that I've posted in Comment of the Day today, because that's exactly what we had in the 1990s, that debt went up a lot, and then the debt situation stabilized because economic growth went up so much. And you know, when you have cheap energy, so much more becomes possible. But of course, it's not just energy that we're getting technological innovation just coming through at a lightning pace, and that's particularly the case in the healthcare sector. So, if people are living longer and are remaining cogent for longer and have the use of their bodies for longer and can see for longer, then individual productivity improves, and you get a bump in economic growth. Well, we're also seeing that technology is improving in terms of education. I remember when I was a kid, I was told that you never really stop learning, and I wasn't particularly enamored with school at the time. And I remember thinking how terrible that was. But in fact, if you can find something that you love to do, then you will want to learn forever. And I think that is the great passion that both David and I feel for this this labor of love that we have, is that we're both endlessly fascinated by the challenge posed by the markets. And I think that is the way that the jobs are likely to go in future, because we're going to be doing them for a long time. But that is a very powerful way of thinking about it. Now, automation is improving and expanding rapidly. So Foxconn this week said that they've displaced 60,000 of their workers and replaced them with robots. China's the workshop of the world, and they're driving towards automation because they want to stay the workshop of the world. They can no longer trade on low labor costs. That ship has certainly sailed, and the kinds of jobs that cannot be automated have already begun to move, and that process has been underway for at least the last 5 or 6 years. So what China is doing is they're automating, and they still have reasonably low labor costs, and that means that they're going to need a lot more energy. They have to really expand everything that has to do with producing energy, and because they don't have domestic supplies of oil, gas, and high quality coal, then they have to go down the renewable route, and they have to go down the nuclear route. Because they're going to have if they're going to achieve the rising living standards that will ensure that the Communist Party can sustain power, then energy per consumption per capita is only going to increase. So then a low energy price environment overall is just phenomenally bullish for the global economy. And it would just, looking at it in terms of the lens through China, but it's incredibly beneficial for high population countries. Obviously not great news for the energy exporters. But by and large, the energy exporters are not particularly large population countries, and the low energy prices could really bolster the global middle class, and you know, and that really is the foundation for a secular bull market. So the stock market has been going up since 2009 and has been going sideways for the last while. And that's really only the S&P. The FTSE 100, for example, has been going sideways for 16 years and is now coming back up towards the upper side of its range. And, you know, and there are a number of energy companies and banks in that index. But there are also a large number of consumer companies which broke out years ago. And the FTSE 350 has largely been going sideways for about a year and a half, but that had broken out to new all-time highs well ahead of the FTSE 100. And when you look at Australia, the potential for energy prices to come lower is really a headwind, because Australia has invested a great deal of money in exporting facilities for natural gas and for iron ore and coal. Well, coal is a benighted sector, and only the lowest cost producers are likely to survive. But you know, the market for coal might be in decline, but it's still the biggest source of for electricity supply globally. Now, when we're talking about this in 30 years' time, we might not make the same claim, but coal is cheap right now, and perhaps it isn't an outright buy, but there are certainly some of those companies look like that they have found support and are beginning to rally. But it's very, I think it's a very risky sector. And certainly not something that one is thinking about in terms of a secular bull market. But use of coal is not going to evaporate overnight, and particularly in the emerging markets. So, you know, if we look at Australia, then the challenge will be to diversify the economy, and the fact that we do have such low interest rates, and that the RBA still has room to cut, suggests that the Australian dollar is not going to be going very much higher than it has already, and that the stock market really does have to be viewed from the perspective of a naturalist, rather than having an opinion about, you know, what it is commodities are doing, and therefore the stock market has to do this, or looking at the property market and how high it is, and thinking that the stock market has to reflect that. We really just have to look at what it is that's happening. And what's happening is that the bank sector has already had a big decline and has begun to at least find support here. And then, you know, if we are going to get lower interest rates, then, you know, we could quite potentially get a bubble. We might already be in bubble valuations for Australian property because of the liquidity infusions that the economy has had, and that bubble might inflate even more. And so, you know, these are the times to really keep an eye on stocks, and to look on the market from the perspective of a naturalist, and to see what is really there, rather than what we think we might see or what we're told we should see. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and wish all the best to all of you.